We live in a day when tolerance has become a highly esteemed virtue. Open-minded people are revered for their grace and lenience. It's an approach that cultivates a don't-sweat-the-small-stuff mentality. But today on Insight for Living, we'll be reminded that the truth is worth guarding at all expense, even if it means going to battle. In the last few days, our attention has been drawn to a brief New Testament postcard. Chuck Swindoll is teaching from the one chapter book of Jude. We're looking at verses 5 through 16 today in a message he's titled, Why Bother to Battle?
Nobody could understand more fully than Jude what it meant to stand alone. Because the man, though unknown in our day, and unpopular among Bible authors or book writers of the Bible, Jude was a man who stood against apostasy. I suppose the point I want to get across at the very beginning is that though no one likes to do battle, it is essential for survival. And only those who have fought can appreciate what it means to stand alone in the gap. That's what Jude does. Let's get acquainted again with him. He says, I've written the book, by mentioning his name first, verse 1. He tells us what his message is in verse 3, and I will remind you from last Sunday, I felt the necessity to write to you appealing that you contend earnestly for the faith. The word contend means to strive with zeal, to battle with gusto, to roll up your sleeves and fight for what is right. And this, in verse 3, is the faith. That you strive valiantly for the faith. And then following that very emotional appeal, in a rather concise and eloquent statement, he says in verse 4, there's a reason for fighting. Look at the apostates. They're called certain persons who have crept in unnoticed. Now get your pencil and mark some things. Mark certain persons in verse 4. He leaves it rather vague because it could have been men or women, could have been young or old, could have been those who were on the front edge of heresy or those that were about to get sucked in and were starting to mouth those false statements. So these certain persons are mentioned. Look again at verse 8. Yet in the same manner, these men, mark that, same group. Drop down to verse 10. But these men revile, mark that, same group. Verse 12 mentions again, these men, as does 14 and 16 and 19. All the way through the book, he is talking about certain kind of people who have done something that's worth fighting against. And they are those that have crept in unnoticed. And remember last Sunday we talked about how the word means to infiltrate. It's the idea of slipping into a pool without making a ripple and becoming a part of the party uninvited. They've been swimming around underneath, but suddenly when they come to the surface, you realize these are not invited guests. But they have made themselves welcome in these subtle ways. Now, when I talk about that this morning, I realize it bears the marks of a negativism and a controversial kind of message which does not characterize this pulpit. But when you go through the Bible, you come to books like this and you declare it. And I'm convinced God has written nothing that is unimportant. Young and old alike can appreciate anew what the battle is all about as a result of understanding Jude. But stay alert now. Let's see how he develops his thought. See in verse 5 where he continues this message of the apostate. He says, I desire to remind you, though you know all things once for all. I realize as I write these words, says Jude, you know all about this business of Old Testament people and stories that I'm going to be mentioning, but you've never put it together so that you see the tentacles and how it reaches back to this subject. So Jude does that for us. Okay? Let's look. Historically, he turns to four triplets. Think of it like that. One, two, three, four, three verses each will take you from 5 to 16. Now, in 5, 6, and 7, he gives the first reason it's worth it to fight. Why bother to battle? Because, first of all, here it comes. The apostate faces a certain doom. And he illustrates it in verses 5, 6, and 7. Because the apostate has rejected the authority of Jesus Christ, he is headed for an eternity in hell. Judgment, punishment, and as unpopular as the subject might be, it's true. Now, Jude writes saying, why do we battle? Because those that are captured by the apostates and brought into those cults have that same future. It's worth it to fight. I'll see them. Here, let's look at the illustrations of this certain doom. Verse 5, I remind you that the Lord, after saving a people out of the land of Egypt, subsequently destroyed those who did not believe. Now, that's not hard to understand. You know this. The people of Israel, when they experienced the Exodus under Moses' leadership and the crossing of that Red Sea miracle, then they came right to the edge of the land of Canaan and they stopped. Why did they stop? Well, they didn't believe they could take that new land, which we know today as Israel. They came right to the southern edge of it, and all ready to go in, they said, now let's send in some spies to check out the land. And 10 came back out of 12 saying, there's no way. And they believed the majority report. And they wandered 38, 39 years until that old generation was destroyed, verse 5 says. Why? Because they did not believe. There was certain doom awaiting those that didn't believe God. What is true of the people of Israel is true of the apostate. No matter how he may phrase his words, no matter how appealing may be his tactic, he faces certain doom as he resists the things of God. Now, there's a second illustration, verse 6. It's a little more complicated. It's the case of the angels. The angels who did not keep their own domain, but abandoned their proper abode, he has kept in eternal bonds under darkness for the judgment of the great day. If you're a Bible student, you have wrestled with the situation in Genesis chapter 6, which is a little bit vague as you read the story in Genesis, but thanks to Jude, it's clarified. The story of Genesis 6 has to do with a strange race of people on the earth called Nephilim, or giants. And the question comes as to how did they come on the earth? Jude tells us there were angels who didn't remain in their proper abode, which would be the heavenly places, but they came and they cohabited with women on earth, of all things, and the result of that cohabitation was a generation of freaks, if you please. Strange creatures called giants. God tells us in verse 6 that these angels that didn't keep their domain have now been judged and preserved in a place awaiting a final judgment. Now, if you got your pencil sharp, note the word in verse 5, destroyed. And in verse 6, judgment. Now, verse 7. He says, just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, since in the same way as these indulged in gross immorality and went after strange flesh, are exhibited as an example in undergoing the punishment of eternal fire. There's the third word, punishment. Certain doom. Have you noticed the flow of things? He begins with Israelites crossing the Red Sea and not believing God regarding the land of promise, and judgment came. And then angels who came and disobeyed God's plan, and judgment came. Now we have a body of Gentile people called Sodomites and Gomorrahites, and they have been judged as well. You may not know it, but the southern end of the Dead Sea has covered up that area known as Sodom and Gomorrah. No doubt in the complete destruction of the area, it simply submerged. It just dropped below and the sea came in, whatever. It is used time and again. In fact, I counted 22 times this week in the Bible. It is used as an illustration of judgment, mentioning Sodom and Gomorrah. To this day, the heinous word lives on in sodomy, just as a reminder of the perversion of the people. Now, why does he mention such situations? Remember the point. He wants to show us that apostasy is bound for certain doom, just as the Israelites, chapter verse 5, as angels, verse 6, as Sodomites, verse 7. There is doom awaiting those that reject God's plan. Now, there is a second reason it's worth it to fight. The second reason is because of their blasphemous tongues, verses 8, 9, and 10. In the same manner, these men, now still talking about apostates, these men, in the same way as those we mentioned earlier, by dreaming, it's a reference to the basis of their thinking, which is just humanistic thought, imagination, man's opinion, defile the flesh and reject authority and revile angelic majesties. They speak blasphemously of things that are dignified. I don't quite know how to say that so that it makes sense, frankly. One of the problems of communication is the battle of getting print from the page into the ears of people in understandable language without losing the thrust of it. And I constantly am a student of how to do that so that it hangs there like riveted nails in our brains. What's the significance of this verse, for example? Well, the verse is saying you can count on apostates to use their tongues in blasphemous ways in that they speak with cynicism of things that are dignified and reverent. There is a gross irreverence that marks the cynic. If you have done much study in the graduate world, you know that that is true. Things that are embraced by the simple believing Christian are assaulted by the apostates with great cynicism. I know a professor right now who teaches in a secular university who says that one of his major goals is to destroy the naive faith of the fundamentalists. That's one of his goals, and he teaches a course on religion, the religions of the world, and he shoots for the jugular vein. That's one of his desires. Very persuasive, very brilliant man who speaks indignantly of things that are majestic to the child of God. The word majesties is from the Greek word doxa. We get the word doxology from it. The angelic glories, which we hold in respect, and we stand back in the mystery of it and say, I don't understand it, but I revere it. It's from God. He has planned that angelic world, and they are part of His ministering spirits, and I respect it. They would take issue with that. Now, as an illustration of it, Jude draws upon a book that was very familiar in his day, but unknown to us, many of us. He says in verse 9, some information found nowhere else in the Bible. He's illustrating the matter of talking evil or speaking blasphemously against angels. And he says, Michael the archangel, when he disputed with the devil and argued about the body of Moses, did not dare pronounce against him a railing judgment, but said, the Lord rebuke you. Aren't you glad you're not preaching right now? Aren't you glad you don't have to explain what that's all about? While you were having fun this week, I was wrestling with what verse 9 was all about. Now, I think I have it in my head, and I want to say it clearly so that you get it. When the Old Testament was finished with the writing of Chronicles, including the minor prophets, And before the New Testament began with the writing of James, the first book to go into circulation, there was about a 400-year period. Are you with me? 400-year intertestamental period. No inspired books were written during that time. But there were books written during that time called the Apocrypha. A number of books that some religions embrace and, in fact, put their roots down into those books to support their position. We do not believe they're inspired. That's why they're not found in our Bible. However, one of those books is called the Assumption of Moses. And it's strange what it has to say. It talks about the post-death period of Moses. Now, the Bible stops in Deuteronomy with the death of Moses, and it says God buried him on the mountain, period. No one knows where that is. But the Assumption of Moses picks up the story and says, Michael the angel took the body of Moses and was en route to bury the body when he was stopped by the devil, who said, "That body is to be mine." Moses is a murderer. Furthermore, Moses' body in matter itself is defiled. It's mine to claim. And the highest of angels, Michael, did not argue with the lowest and grossest of creatures, an angel also in his origin, the devil. He simply said, "The Lord rebuke you," and he carried out the task. Now, the point of it all is this. If the highest of all angels will not speak with defilement or will not revile one like Satan, neither should man speak evil of things that are considered dignified and reverent. But apostates do. They take super delight in defiling things that believers consider precious. When Antiochus Epiphanes invaded and took over the temple of the Jews, knowing that there had never been anything but the blood of a lamb spilled on that place of holy presence, he took a sow and he sliced its throat and splashed the blood of that hog all the way through that temple, as if to say, in all of those expletives deleted, "This is my feeling about things you consider reverent." Now, that's the whole point of this passage. Those apostates will take the things that you set aside and hold in awesome reverence, and they will defile them. They will speak sarcastically and cynically of those precious things of the faith. These men, verse 10, revile the things which they do not understand. That's rationalism. Driven by a rational mind, they look at things that require faith to believe, and they say, "We reject it." Furthermore, it says, "And the things which they know by instinct, like unreasoning animals, by these things they're destroyed." That's humanism. The spokesman in the Christian camp, as it relates to an anti-humanistic position, is, of course, Francis Schaeffer. Dr. Schaeffer is a prolific writer, and I'm sure you've read a number of his works. The latest one that I've gotten a hold of and have begun to appreciate is "How Should We Then Live?" And in that book, Dr. Schaeffer has traced secular humanism from its origin to its present condition in America. Ah, what a panorama. And there are available today films on the subject of the roots of humanism and how they have traced across our land and now taken its toll right up to the top of our educational institutions. And I thought it was interesting in the book and rather eloquent summary of the erosion of our times when he talks about the first line of the 23rd Psalm as an illustration. When the faith was first introduced to our land, the 23rd Psalm says, "The Lord is my shepherd." As humanism began to roll over from the old country, and take its roots here, we began to say, I am my shepherd. And then we began to believe it so much, we turned and said, the sheep are my shepherd. And then, buying it hook, line, and sinker, everything is my shepherd. And finally, the bottom line, nothing is my shepherd. And he portrays both in a graphic form, verbally as well as with pictures, the emptiness, for example, of the drug culture. And the whole sub-world that humanism sends us into. And with these choice words, he wraps it up. There is a death wish inherent in humanism. Now, I don't know if I'm hitting over your head or into it or where, but I want to say today something I think everybody will understand. You want to know how to pray for your kids? Pray for them when they are under the gun of secular humanism. That's where you pray for them. And it's not happening in this church. It will happen outside this church, in places where their minds are being stretched and bent and shaped. Talk about asking God to raise up prophets. Ask Him to raise them up in the educational world. Ask Him to raise them up among those who will be in the upper echelon of learning. Not only high school level, but college level and graduate school level, so that somehow there can be at least a battle, not just a one fell swoop and they're in. I'll tell you, my hat goes off to every man or woman that does battle in the realm of education as people of God. God bless you for your stand in dealing with the reasoning world outnumbered by unreasonable people. We need you. May your tribe increase and multiply. May God honor your stand. You're part of the answer. Never, ever forget that. I can't get in. I'm a marked man. I'm a preacher. I'm paid to say it. But I'll tell you, when you say it, there's another line that comes across. It's got a ring of authenticity. Suddenly they're thinking, maybe that's right. Not even a preacher. You never knew you had it so good. Because there's certain doom for the apostates. That's number one. Number two, because there's blasphemy on their tongues. That's the second reason. Here's the third. You got to battle and battle with all your might is because they are spiritually empty.
It's certainly a battle worth fighting. Keeping the gospel pure as we guard against apostasy. You're listening to Insight for Living and another message from Chuck Swindoll in the series called New Testament Postcards. Now, to order the 6 CDs or to download the complete sermons, go online to insightworld.org. At Insight for Living, we're always looking for ways to help you grow deeper in your walk with God by providing materials that complement these daily studies. If you received Chuck's letter this month, you know we're pleased to offer a brand new devotional called Shaping the Modern Disciple. 15 men, 15 chapters, 15 practical lessons. And the book is spiral bound, making it easy to jot down your thoughts while leaving the devotional open as you cross-reference your Bible. Again, the book is called Shaping the Modern Disciple, and it's yours when you give a donation of any amount. If you're listening in the United States, call 1-800-772-8888 or go online to insight.org. And let me add that we're especially grateful to a growing circle of friends who have come alongside Chuck and the team at Insight for Living. If you're a monthly companion, please accept our profound thanks. A monthly companion agrees to give a recurring donation every month, and signing up is quick and simple. As a monthly companion, you can have the satisfaction of knowing you're doing your part to make these daily programs possible. As a listener-supported, not-for-profit ministry, Insight for Living incurs a number of expenses in bringing Chuck's teaching to your station, over the internet, and through the convenient mobile app. And as you value this program, and as you share our commitment to guard the truth, we invite you to partner with us in this way. So to become a monthly companion right now, Simply go to insight.org/monthly companion.
Travel with Chuck Swindoll and your friends at Insight for Living on a cruise to Norway.
Honestly, I've never seen such colorful displays. The flower boxes in Norway are choked with blooms. And it's all complemented by impeccable cleanliness and generous hospitality in the urban centers as well as the quaint countryside villages. It's all so friendly.
Mark your calendar for July 26th through August 2nd, 2014, to experience the majestic fjords of Norway on board Holland America's elegant Rotterdam cruise ship.
We'll have plenty of time to see the sights and refreshing times to praise and worship, too.
For the Insight for Living cruise to Norway, July 2014, call 888-447-0444 or online go to insight.org/events.
Relax and restore. Create memories that will last a lifetime.
You have lots of options for taking a vacation, but there's only one Insight for Living cruise to Norway. Call 888-447-0444. Or online, go to insight.org/events.
The Insight for Living cruise to Norway is paid for and made possible by only those who choose to attend.
I'm Dave Spiker. There's much more teaching from Chuck Swindoll about New Testament postcards coming up Monday, right here on Insight for Living.
The preceding message, Why Bother to Battle?, was copyrighted in 1977, and the sound recording was copyrighted in 2014 by Charles R. Swindoll, Inc. All rights are reserved worldwide.